funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How closely does today's America resemble what the Founding Fathers intended? And how is it that so many Americans venerate the Constitution they gave us, even as we argue incessantly over what that prescribes? My guest today is fascinated by the power of this very brief document to guide more than two centuries of American history, even as it sits at the heart of our most intractable disagreements. Writer and comedian Colin Quinn spent 5 years on Saturday Night Live and hosted the show Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. He'll be in town to perform his one-man stage show Unconstitutional this Friday, January 10th at the Wiley Theater in Dallas. He joins us today from the studios of Argo in New York City. Colin, welcome to Think.
Thanks.
I want to thank you for going out in the cold to meet up with us, by the way.
Yeah. It's 7 degrees.
Yeah. Just seven.
Yeah.
That's really crazy. Unusual even for New York.
I've never seen it like this.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you again for getting out of your warm apartment and meeting up with us. So we constantly praise the brilliance of the Constitution, and you wanted to know why. So you pulled it out and read it. What was your initial impression?
My initial impression was shocked that it was only 4 pages. but then I said I'd do. The problem with the Constitution is you have to read. If you just read 4 pages, you don't really understand it. You have to read the stupid Federalist Papers, which is a real hassle, but it explains a lot of it. And you have to read all these books on the making of the Constitution. And then you have to do what I do, which is pretend to read Cicero and pretend to read all the people that inspired the constitutional scholars.
Mm-hmm. And did you call up scholars as well and consult with, like, professors and people who study this all the time?
No, because, because I was, you know, I'm a comedian, so I don't want to get too, I was looking for the general, like, comedians generalize, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so I was looking for, like, what the psychology was of us now. Like, what I would do is I almost work backwards, like, I would look at how we are now, our personalities as Americans, and then try to connect it to the constitutional document.
Hmm. What's funny is that we all feel like total experts on this thing. It's almost like the Bible. We can read almost anything we want into it if we claim that it came from the Constitution.
Exactly. It's just like the Bible, exactly, in the sense that people do interpret it whatever's convenient to their way of thinking, of course.
Is there something you think uniquely American about the fact that we are always so sure that our take on things as individuals is valid?
No, universal? But I do think that there's a natural tendency to, like, the Constitution does teach you self-esteem. You know, like, people always talk about the self-esteem movement of the past 30 years or whatever. And everyone's selfish or whatever. But that's sort of the Constitution. This is where it's been going the whole time, because it kind of teaches you, like, your rights as an individual, you know? I mean, the Bill of Rights part, where it's sort of like you're as valuable as your vote counts like anybody else. So it does teach you to have that mindset, which is great and terrible at the same time.
One thing you discovered in your research is that the Constitution was conceived and written during what amounted to, like, a 4-month bender.
Yeah, I mean, that they were drinking all day and all night. It's so funny. But it does make sense. Like, if right now, if you were a member of Congress and they told you, you don't have to rush out of there to go to the bar, we're going to bring the bar to you, people would spend more time in Congress, in session, you know? So it does make sense.
Do you think they were actually intoxicated? I mean, I always assume that people drank more alcohol because they couldn't trust the water, that sort of thing. Is there evidence that they were drunk?
There was no evidence that they were drunk except the amount they drank every day. It was like giant. I mean, the bills of sale every day were ridiculously high. But it was also alcohol was less potent those days.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they were arguing about this as they went along. And one thing that they sort of brilliantly understood was that we were not going to get any less argumentative as a society. And I guess they designed the Constitution to accommodate for that.
Yeah, I mean, that was the real brilliance of it, is that they understood, like, what's happening right now is sort of, like, they would not be shocked by anything that's happening right now. They'd be like, yeah, I guess this makes sense. That's how people are, you know? Like, they understood human nature. They understood power. They understood the fact that everybody wants to tell everybody else how to think, you know?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing to me last month when there was that small, almost procedural deal on the budget, and it was heralded like the Treaty of Versailles, like finally everyone's getting along.
Right, right, right. I know. It's really gotten particularly extreme lately, I guess. But it's definitely strange that that people are shocked by it, because the founding father, they were fighting this whole time. I mean, most, you know, a lot of people walked out. Some people didn't show up. Half the people were totally unhappy with it. You know, some of the big names like Patrick Henry and George Mason didn't even sign it. They were just Patrick Henry wouldn't show up. George Mason wouldn't sign it. So, I mean, it's kind of an interesting, it's been conflict from the beginning.
Do you think that they went into this project with a sense of humility? Because right now, the way we imagine them is probably nothing like the way it really was. They were living, breathing people. Do you think they thought to themselves, we are creating this very important document that will influence the rest of the Western world for, you know, time immemorial?
Well, they kind of wrote, a lot of them did write that kind of grandiose things about the other guys, you know, that these guys are demigods and, you know, these are the most brilliant minds in history. I mean, there wasn't that much humility there, that's for sure. they definitely thought pretty well of themselves for the most part, you know.
This is really amazing. I mean, slavery was already something that was cause for conflict among the different states. And yet, when the Constitution was written, the only way they could get this thing signed was to basically put this issue on the back burner.
Yeah. They have a committee of postponed matters, and that was a big committee. You know, like that was like an important committee.
Was that the actual name? The Committee of Postponed
Matters?
Yeah,
Committee of Postponed Matters. But slavery was even bigger than that. They didn't even have it on that committee. It was just one of those things they dealt with right away, and they're like, "Look, this is serious." All the northern states were like, "We got to get rid of this. This is, you know." And they were like, "No, we're not getting rid of it." They're like, "Okay, well, I guess we'll just deal with it down the road." So they had like, you know, where they after like 18, I forget what year, 1811 or something, no more, 1803, no more slaves are going to be imported, allowed to be brought over. So you just have to breed slaves, you know. And it's funny, when I saw that movie 12 Years a Slave, you know, I was like, oh, like that happened right after there was some kind of ban. I remember when I saw it, and I was like, that's why they tried to kidnap. This guy was a free man.
Yeah.
That they kidnapped in the real story. And I was like, yeah, because they weren't allowed to import slaves right after that. Maybe that was the year or something, like something about it was significant that reminded me of the Constitution.
And it's still, I mean, race is still something that we're kicking down the road that we kind of assume will work itself out.
Well put. I talk about that in the show a lot, is that discussion delayed, as what happens to a discussion delayed, deferred, is still a big issue that nobody, but it's also because the culture of today, in my opinion, is so politically correct that if you did want to have a racial discussion, unless you were just, you know, basically genuflecting and, you know, mea culpa, racism is evil, that's the only acceptable conversation, is to say racism is bad and it still exists, and just to drop it at that. And there's so many more layers to it on both sides that need to be brought out and discussed. And it'll never happen because people don't accept, you know, especially in the media, but in general, people don't accept anything other than, you know, this kind of lockstep mentality about what's acceptable to say about race or anything, you know.
Well, one thing that I know you point out is the idea that, like, white Americans, the only time they want to talk about race is when they want to, like, point the finger at another white American and say, you are racist.
That's it. That's the only acceptable racial discussion now, is white people playing the race card on the other white people. And then everyone's like, whew, that was close. We always had a racial discussion.
Well, why do you think it's, I mean, I guess no one, if a person were to say, yeah, I guess I am a little bit racist. I mean, that label sticks, and it sort of causes everybody to look at you forever after as a terrible person.
Yeah, no, it's become the communist of whatever the communist was in the 1950s. That would be racist today, sure.
Do you think it's easier for, I mean, are there younger people that are talking about this more successfully?
No, they've been brought into a society of lies and phoniness. So how would they be able to talk about it? They don't even know. They're not even going to be able to come from a place of reality to start that conversation.
So we look to the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution for us. Is it possible to strip the partisanship from that body?
I mean, first of all, the Supreme Court is the most screwed up thing. I still don't believe. I mean, that's the one they really where you really say, OK, geniuses, what was this supposed to do? The Supreme Court is just I mean, it's the most troubling, you know, the lifetime job, you know, that it's only nine at the time, 12. But it's like it just doesn't work that well. You know, they all it's the good thing about it. It's a focal point for everything that's wrong with us. You know, The fact that people vote partisan completely on the Supreme Court, too, is for the most part is a pretty good indicator. You know, when somebody jumps off the reservation, everybody has a heart attack, you know, and it is a good bellwether for the country. That I'll say for the Supreme Court, you know.
It is always strange when someone sort of, goes rogue and stops voting the way that they were supposed to have done by the person who appointed them.
They get vilified, yeah.
Well, vilified or celebrated by the other side.
Barely. I mean, what's his name? The guy that voted for Obamacare.
Roberts. Is it Roberts?
Roberts, yeah. I mean, he's vilified by the right and not celebrated by the left. And the same thing happened with, what's his face? Joe Lieberman, when he was a Democrat, but he voted for something, Israel or whatever. And he got vilified by the left and not celebrated by the right. So it's like, unless you're completely uniform down the line with your party, in today's culture, it feels like people look at you like, ah, that person's kind of a sellout. Just because they might have, you know, a conflict or they're not 100% down the line with you. It's really absurd.
Well, it's the same way. Have you ever heard like a priest or a rabbi say a swear word and everybody's so shocked? It's like we expect them to sort of like stick to a party line in a way that most regular people don't, right? Most people who identify with one party or the other might have an opinion here or there that's different.
Right. But I don't think it's the people that really expect that. It's sort of like their peers. That's what's so weird about it. Because if a rabbi heard a curse word from another rabbi, he'd understand.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like if the rabbi, it's almost as if a rabbi cursed or a priest cursed and the rest of the rabbis were like, whoa, I can't imagine. This guy's a sellout. Instead of going, come on, you know, don't be. So it's really a strange world right now as far as it's hyper, you know, divided. And it's high. It's like the extremists. You know, my favorite quote, like any Irish person, has got to be like a Yeats quote. But he said about the Easter Uprising of 1916, the worst were filled with passionate intensity. The best lacked all conviction, you know. And I feel like if some politician came across that lacked passionate intensity and that kind of had kind of just, you know what I mean, just didn't – said, look, I don't have any conviction. I'm trying to figure this out. People would go, this guy is just bad. He's not what we want. Like people want these fake personalities that would just get up there and go, guys – here's what we're going to do. Instead of being like, look, here's what we're going to try to do.
Yeah.
You know, we all know the way the world works. We all know history certainly doesn't bear it out. And as far as I feel about the right and left, they both have a lot of nerve being in any way righteous because we've proven, if nothing else, that neither side really has the answer yet.
My guest is writer and comedian Colin Quinn. He spent 5 years on Saturday Night Live. He'll be in Dallas this Friday, January 10th, to perform his one-man stage show, Unconstitutional. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer and comedian Colin Quinn. His one-man stage show, Unconstitutional, will be performed Friday night, January 10th at the Wiley Theater in Dallas. You can join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Colin, I think one reason that politicians have to be so laser-focused on bullet points and message points and the party line is because there are people in my profession who are just sort of waiting around to pounce on anything that they say that seems to be unfair or inconsistent. What role do you think the coverage of politics has on the way politics is done in America today?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it has a big role. It's got that paparazzi feel to it now, you know. And it's funny because the Constitutional Convention, they kept the press out. They wouldn't let them in for 4 months, for the entire time.
So they were able to sort of have frank conversations.
Yeah, to a degree. And I feel like the press obviously is such an important part of the whole conversation. But like anything else, everything becomes corrupt, you know, everything that gets. And now it's almost like less corrupt because there's so many outlets that in a way it's unwieldy. It's kind of people are just going towards whatever they're attracted to as far as press wise. But it's also less civilized. But it's, you know, I guess in some ways it's the ultimate open market.
So have you been a news junkie forever, like long before Weekend Update? Has this just been a function of your adult life?
What has been?
Following the news really closely.
No, I actually started. It's funny you say that because I did start around Weekend Update.
Really?
Yeah.
And so it must have been interesting if you took a deep interest at that moment when you were sort of looking to find the things that were funny,
right,
or bizarre.
No, I think I'm just like most other people in this country. Like, one day you just find yourself watching all this news. Like, if you mentioned all this political stuff like 20 years ago, people go, all right, what are you, a news junkie? Now the whole country is like this. Everybody knows what's going on at all times. Everybody watches cable news and everybody's kind of like got opinions on everything that goes on. It's a whole different culture, you know?
And that doesn't necessarily mean we're any better informed about it than we ever were.
No, it doesn't. No, it does not. And plus, the other weird thing is, like, everybody knows, like, it's sort of like news combines with Miley Cyrus and morphs into where you don't know what's TMZ and what's, you know, CNN or whatever, you know.
So do you look for specific kinds of stories when you pick up a newspaper? Or do you pick up a newspaper? Do you read online? How do you get your news?
Yeah, I just read online. You know, whatever pops up, I'll read and then see where it goes, you know, see what that leads to. Like, you know, like you know how it is now. You read something and then the side article, you're like, oh, what's that? And then suddenly you're reading something from like 30 years ago.
Right. and you don't necessarily, yeah, you can spend an hour and a half on something that you did not intend to follow necessarily.
Yeah. And I feel like ultimately there's no conclusion that's drawn yet where there's a solution or an answer to anything. It seems like everything's criticism. You know, it's just a society of armchair quarterbacks. And, you know, criticism's important, but nobody has a solution. But nobody has the humility to go, okay, I don't see a solution on either end. And there is none yet, you know.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Eddie on the line in Dallas. Hey, Eddie.
Hey, love your show.
Thank you.
Mr. Quinn, I saw you at Caroline several years ago. You were absolutely side-splitting funny.
Thanks.
Two quick questions, and I'll hang up and listen. Seems like, I mean, guys like Carlin, at least the early Carlin and Pryor, were intensely political, but more subtle and less kind of angry than, say, maybe like a Bill Maher or what's that guy who did Weekend Update who's now the right-wing comedian or whatever?
Dennis Miller?
Yeah, Dennis Miller. See, those guys are, like, really mad and yelling at me. I didn't get that sense. So I'd like your perspective on that. And, well, how do you view the constitutional thing on issues where both sides absolutely are convinced that they are holding to the Constitution and the other side? So like the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman thing, or a less extreme version, campaign finance. So I'll shut up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
I was going to say that's a lot of questions. But for the first question, yeah, I think, like I said, I think that people in general are more like strident now. So comedy is getting a little strident. Plus, Richard Pryor and George Carlin, they were like socio-political more than actually political. It was a different time. And in defense of modern comedians, there was no competition. I mean, Pryor and Carlin are the most brilliant comedians of all time. But they were up against about 8 guys. Now there's about 10,000 people doing comedy. So people are a little more hyper. But the other, I really made myself laugh on that one. It was like, what's so funny? I'm sitting there cackling to myself.
Did you do a show? You did a show with George Carlin once, right?
Yeah, he was on my show. I loved it so much. He actually signed an album for me, one of my old Carlin albums. And it said, I don't know if I can say this. I said, Colin. I asked him to sign. I told him the whole story, how I bought the album, how he inspired me, being Irish from New York. And he signed the album, Colin, blow me, George Carlin. I was like, oh, thanks, George. But part two was the Constitution. Yeah, that's the whole point. How do you rectify a situation like Trayvon Martin or anything where people are totally convinced and everybody has an argument that's valid or that seems valid when they say it, where you can't argue with, and that's where the Supreme Court's supposed to come in. But the Supreme Court, like I said, for whatever reason, that particular part of the Constitution was never really ironed. I feel like it's never really been ironed out correctly. So, you know, I feel like it should be a shifting job. That's what everybody says, obviously. You know, nobody expected life. When they wrote the Constitution, they didn't expect lifetime politicians or lifetime Supreme Court justices, maybe, although I don't know. Maybe they did. But they didn't expect life. Congress was going to be a couple of, you know, nobody was going to be doing that. They were just like gentlemen that would come in, do it for a few years, and then go back to their life, you know. So I don't know. I really don't know what the solution is to that. If I did know the solution, I'm glad I don't know, because if I did know, I'd probably be, you know, in a position of great power in this country. I'd be a benign dictator if I could really. I mean, really, a benign dictatorship's the only thing that actually works for everybody. Democracies and republics, they're not going to work.
Well,
they're not going to make people happy. It's always going to be this conflict.
And there's not always, I mean, it's not always that one thing is absolutely right and one thing is absolutely wrong. And that's the thing that no document ever can you know, get beyond. It's possible for two different things to be right, depending on the situation.
But that's what I think James Madison understood. Like, once again, I'll throw my Federalist Papers card out now.
Listen, if you've read them, you own that, yeah.
I really do get proud of myself when I throw out the Federalist Papers. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's usually this one, sadly, by the way. So it's not like I have the whole Federalist Papers memo. But I think it's 10, Federalist Papers 10. And it's James Madison, and he talks about people are going to have natural different interests. That's just the way it is. He goes, debtors, landowners, and merchants, everybody's going to have natural different interests. He said that's just the way it's going to be. That's like that natural law type thing. And he goes, that's what we have to deal with. We have to deal with the fact that nobody's ever going to have the same interests. That's just human nature. So whatever, to keep what they call factions, that's the whole faction section. He goes, so factions, we're going to have to live. He goes, if we get rid of liberty, we'll get rid of factions. He goes, but that's like, I forget the metaphor, for putting out the fire to save whatever. But he's basically saying that's how it's going to be. There's going to be conflict this whole time.
So I went online and I looked at your tour schedule and I saw the upcoming dates. But were you touring this show before the holidays or have you just been in New York before this?
Yeah, before the holidays, I was in the 13 colonies. I did all the colonies first, you know.
I'm curious about...
That was our hook.
did that bring the people in who wanted to...
It didn't have the marketing value that I thought it would. But when you call a show... Anywhere, whenever you use the word Constitution in your show, you're not expecting a breakout hit.
Well, I wonder, like you know, when you go on and talk about the Second Amendment, I would imagine the response in places like Virginia and here in Texas is different than if you go to Massachusetts or New York and talk about the same things.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny because everybody just assumes, I feel like when I go to Massachusetts or I go to, like, the Northeast, and I'm talking about the Second Amendment, and down south, they both assume the same things, which is they're going to hear, you know, just that guns are bad. So, like, the people up north are kind of relaxed, like, aha, Second Amendment, guns are bad. And then when I say anything about guns being bad, they laugh. Mm-hmm. And then the other stuff, they just kind of, like, sit through, like, all right, I guess he likes guns, too, so... And the down south, the minute I start talking about it, everyone gets tense. Like, oh, here he comes, some show business anti-gun, you know, dirtbag hippie. And then when I say anything good about guns, then they laugh. So, and then anything I say bad about guns, they just kind of slide past, you know. Although when I was in Virginia, I did Radford, and that's where Wayne LaPierre grew up. He went to Radford High School. So after the show, all these, like, old Virginia people going, well, I went to high school with Wayne LaPierre. And that was so funny. So it was like, but it is funny to watch people's different reactions, you know.
Do you think people go to your shows thinking they have you pinned down?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think so, because I don't know how they could if I don't even have me pinned down, you know. So it's kind of hard for me to, it's hard for me to say, I mean, you know, where I stand. I mean, I was a registered Democrat my whole life, but I don't agree with a lot of what they say, and I don't agree with a lot of what the Republicans say. I just don't agree. You know, I wish there was I call myself an independent, but everyone's like, oh, so who does an independent vote for you? Vote for? Even independents don't know. They're like, I don't know. Is there a candidate for independents? It's like, no, but you just call yourself one and then you vote. So it's kind of a weird, it's a weird place to be, I guess, you know. But a lot of people, like you said, a lot of people have things on both sides that they agree with and disagree with.
You know, in Texas, you don't have to register for one party or the other. You can only vote in one primary, but you can pick whichever one you want.
Oh, well, that would be good. But I mean, but even then, I don't know if I'd vote for Republicans or Democrats. I just feel like I wish there were like three or four parties that were like all viable every time, you know?
So Eddie mentioned that he saw you at Caroline's a few years ago. I think this is interesting that you've done a couple of these one-man shows, but then you keep doing stand-up all the time, basically, right?
Yeah. I mean, I love stand-up, and it's like a lot of this is stand-up. A lot of this is stand-up. I mean, the great thing about stand-up is that it develops the muscle where even though they're going to be watching a show about the Constitution, they're going to be laughing the whole time because stand-up trains you where you're uncomfortable if you don't get a laugh for like 40 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. The bad thing about stand-up is that it can keep you from doing this kind of stuff because you're like, wait a minute, the crowd doesn't... you know, the crowd's not laughing. I have to make sure I put in like a dick joke or something, you know. So you can't let yourself fall into that thing. You have to be disciplined on both sides of that. You know, you can't not get laughs because I'm there to make people laugh. You know, like that's my ultimate goal.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I'm there to say, look, wait a minute. I'm not just going to make some stupid joke to get a cheap laugh, which wouldn't work in this show anyway because it would stand out. But, I mean, you're still trying to do both, and that's kind of – that's – it's good. Stand-up is great training for this kind of stuff because it keeps me from not getting – you know, it makes me get laughs the whole time, you know.
So how do you write? Are you, like, sitting down in front of a computer, or do you walk around and say things aloud and take notes?
I sit down in front of a computer a lot of times. What happens, I'll think of something, then I'll put it on my phone, you know, just on my notes on my phone. And then I'll go back. I'll try to write it a little bit on the computer, although I used to be much more disciplined about that. And then I'll try it out that night. I'll listen to the tape, and I'll go, oh, that's where the joke, that's what I was trying to say. And then I'll get it like that.
Hmm. And the one thing you can never control, I guess, is like how much your audience has had to drink.
That's why I love doing theaters over stand-up clubs, because in stand-up clubs, you can't control how drunk they are, and they're always really drunk.
Yeah.
There's always a few drunken idiots that are, like, trying to dominate the show.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't spend their money to spend their Friday, Saturday, whatever night and come out and listen to their table yap, you know? So, like, that's the thing that infuriates me about clubs. And I mean infuriates me. And so I hate that. But so at least in a theater, people have one or two drinks, but they're not talking during the show. I don't care if they're drunk. I don't care if they're passed out. I don't care if they're sexting during my show. Just shut up and listen so that it doesn't ruin it for everybody else, you know?
Well, it's so funny because of all art forms, like you wouldn't go to the opera and get really tanked and start singing along with like the tenor, you know? But somehow people feel like they can do that if they go to a stand-up show.
That's true. Although people do sing at concerts a lot, and that infuriates me too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, like
whenever I go to a show, it's like, oh, I'm listening to you sing. Oh.
Yeah, it's not quite loud enough for you not to hear the people behind you.
No, you're right. For some reason, stand-up has always had that thing. I guess because of the drinking and because it was always at nightclubs, you know. But it does have that thing where people, because when it's not working, everybody's thinking, I'm funnier than this person. Whereas a singer, even if they're not great, nobody's thinking, I sing better. Well, a few people are, but most people aren't like, they can still, if you can play guitar and you can't play guitar, those are facts. But if you're funny and the other person's, that it's not a fact that that person in the crowd is not funnier than you at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not being funny. Whereas if you're playing guitar, it's a fact that even if you suck as a guitarist, the other person can't play.
Yeah.
So it brings out that other side of things, I guess.
Well, and there's also the difference between, like, your friends think you're funny and being able to stand up in front of a group of people and perform for them. They're not the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, they could be if they develop. I mean, I know people, obviously we all know people that are as funny as anybody in stand-up comedy. You know a couple of friends, they're funny.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, it's that other muscle of saying, okay, not only am I funny in front of my friends, that's how it has to start. But then you have to then say, I'm going to devote my life. I'm going to wreck the rest of my life, basically, to make this thing that I do in front of my friends for joy into an actual art that I can make a living doing, you know?
My guest is writer and comedian Colin Quinn. He spent 5 years on Saturday Night Live. His new stage show, one-man show, Unconstitutional, will come to the Wiley Theater in Dallas this Friday, January 10th. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and performer Colin Quinn. His one-man show, Unconstitutional, comes to the Wiley Theater in Dallas this Friday night, January 10th. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Paul in Plano. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. Kind of interesting. It's a very interesting topic because within the last month or so, I kind of wondered about this proposition. So I'll put it to your guest, and that is, if the memory of the Constitution were erased, some aliens invaded, they erased all the case law, they erased everything, and we had to start from scratch today and put a Constitution together. Would we be able to do it, and what would be the three areas of contention that we would have to try to address, like slavery for them and some other women's rights and various other things? What would be the three areas that we would have to, that you'd find the greatest fights about?
I wish I'd thought of that question myself, Paul. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I wish I'd thought of the answer myself. it's a hard question. Some of the things that are still unresolved from our Constitution— namely, debt. Like, we have the same problems, amazingly enough, from the original Constitution. Like, debt, for example, was a big one. States' rights versus federal rights. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's still the big contention things are still about money and about states versus federal rights. You know, like, what's our confederacy of states? Confederacy in the sense of, you know, how conjoined are we, And where does that overlap between the federal and the state rights? And then I guess you could say naturalization, too. I mean, you could say immigration was still an issue of today, you know. Like, boy, a lot of border stuff, you know, there's a lot of trade stuff. Like, trade would probably be the big one, too. It would probably be trade, debt, and state and federal rights, I guess, you know. And those are all connected, too, I know. But, I mean, those are all separate things that were in the original Constitution that are still today big unresolved issues.
I fear, though, that we'd get all hung up on, like, marijuana, you know.
Yes, I believe that kind of stuff could be, although now obviously it's not, but yeah, it was definitely, it's been quite a charade for the past 40 years over that, right?
Do you vote at like the, you know, dog catcher and municipal judge level?
No, I mean, I vote like, you know, mayor and stuff like that. And I'll vote, whatever's there, I'll vote for, you know, assemblyman, even though I barely know what I'm doing. But I mean, I don't vote. I mean, it's Manhattan. I figure, hey, somebody should be taking care of that.
Like someone who's paying attention to local issues.
Yeah. They should have an administration. In Manhattan, we have like, you know, an administration of canine acquisition. They don't have dog catcher. They have like there's a whole minor system in place for dog catching, you know.
What do you think about the new mayor?
I mean, right away, my first opinion is no. Although I'm kind of conflicted because stop and frisk, I kind of believe in stop and frisk, even though it really probably is unconstitutional. So, I mean, what does that say about me? I'm violating the Constitution right away. I feel like...
Well, you're a white guy, I guess. Maybe that's what it says
right,
about you.
Right, a white guy, but it's not just... No, but if I was a black... If I'm black living in a black neighborhood and some kids are walking around with suspicious bulges under their coats, and I know the cops can't even stop them. It's two sides to everything.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, if you're living in a black neighborhood and you know there's kids walking around with guns and the cops can't pull them over, that makes you feel scared and powerless. On the other hand, if you're a black kid and you feel like the cops can just pull you over, it makes you mad, you know? So I feel like, once again, these are all racial issues that are not being discussed, because the only way to discuss them is just to say, stop and frisk is bad or stop and frisk is good. And so when you can't have a discussion on these things without it being immediately, without acknowledging, yeah, there's race involved in every conversation in this country. That's just how it is. But to automatically just dismiss it and suppress it, kind of like, I remember when that, it's just any time somebody tries to bring up a racial discussion, unless they speak what's considered correct on either side, it's suppressed. That's how it is. Or it's dismissed or ridiculed, you know?
What do you make of the pressure on SNL to hire a black woman for the cast this year when that had not been part of the original plan?
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously, I would have thought once Michelle Obama was Barack Obama's wife,
yeah,
that they would have said, we better get a black woman to play her, right? But at the same, that's the one side. It seems ridiculous to me on the one hand, right, to not have a black woman in the SNL cast. On the other hand, what people won't talk about, for example, is that there's black and white TV shows. You know what I mean? Black people don't watch SNL for the most part, you know?
Really?
And white people don't watch BET. No, black people don't watch SNL. I mean, they'll watch once in a while if there's a black host, maybe, but it's not. I bet if you look, I don't know. I don't read the demographics. I mean, I don't read but I'm just saying, in general, I would say SNL's audience is probably mostly white. But people don't like to ever say anything like that. Nobody likes to admit there's movies black people go see, there's movies white people go see, there's TV shows that black people go see, TV shows that white people go see, music, same thing. It's kind of, people are kind of segregated today as much as Selma in the 1920s in many ways. And so it's like nobody will even have that discussion to admit that and then go, oh, so what do we think of this? And then have the discussion about how many people should be of each race on each show. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nobody can even admit the basic truths.
Did you have to go into that show? I mean, you know, I only know about the history of SNL through what's reported in the media, and I don't know how accurate any of that is. It seems like some people have a great experience there, and other people feel like they really just get chewed up and spit out.
Right.
Is it not good to get on the cast when you're 22 years old and don't have much life experience, and is it better to be a little older when you arrive?
Well, I mean, I had both experiences, but you know, so I feel like SNL, it depends at the time you got there. You know, like there was different vibes at different times, I feel, too. You know, like just imagine any office or anything. You come in and either things start to swing your way or they don't. And when they don't, you know, it's uncomfortable. You know, you start to feel like weird there, you know, and you start to feel like, oh, everything you do. And it sort of perpetuates where suddenly you're stumbling, you're losing your confidence. I mean, so much of comedy and entertainment is that level of confidence, too. So when you're starting to feel like, uh-oh, what's going on here? Am I on the bubble or whatever? It starts to affect your performance.
Yeah, because then you don't take risks.
Yeah, because you feel like, and when you do take, you know, things just turn like anything else. When people turn on you, they just turn on. You know, that's just how it goes. When the tide turns on you, that's the way it goes in anything. And so SNL, a lot of very talented people, things didn't work out, and it wasn't always them, you know. But it's just the way it goes. It's just that momentum just starts to go, you know.
Do you keep up with the show? Like, do you DVR it and try to watch it?
No, but I do watch it. I mean, I keep up with it as far as I'll watch some of it. I'll watch it on Hulu. I'll watch some of the sketch, you know, if I hear about something funny. Mm-hmm. But I can't watch the whole thing anymore because I just, you know, there's other things I'm interested in. But I know the show so well, too, that when I watch it, I like to watch the opening because I know everyone's backstage. I know the excitement level of everybody because that's the thing about SNL. The thing about SNL that makes it still kind of a magic thing is that excitement level before it's about to start, you know, where everyone's just like, oh, my God, it's going live. You know what I mean? It becomes like a big thing. The host is always excited. Everybody's kind of excited. You know, there's a live audience. The show's live when very few things are live nowadays, really live, you know.
It's kind of amazing that it maintains that even after people have been doing it for years on end. And it's so like the machine around it is so professional, you know.
Yes, exactly. The machine is so professional, and that, but it's still ultimately some human being has to get out there who's in their mid, late 20s and has to say these lines, and they might get a laugh and they might not get a laugh. And that's what always keeps people, I think, coming back, you know. It's like, uh-oh, do they have it this week or is this going to be like, oh. And, you know, stand-up comedy is the same thing, but there's not a TV camera on you. It's just a live show, which is still exciting, but this is a live show and millions of people are watching at home. So it's got a real vibe to it. You know, it's got a real stakes, as they say, you know.
What did you all do to compensate if there was a host that you thought, wow, this person may be a great singer or TV star, but they are not a live performer?
Most of the time, the people that you were looking forward to hosting, it went terrible. And the people you were like, oh, this host is going to be bad, those were the good shows.
Just because you can't tell?
An amazing amount of the time, yeah. Because I think your expectations when somebody's good, everyone's writing, saving their perfect sketch for it, you know? And then it ends up like that host doesn't want to do it or something. And you're like, I saved that for that person, you know? And they just, or went bad at read through or something. Just these little things, human things would happen. And then to some host, you're like, oh, my God, this person's a, you know, it's an athlete or, you know, they don't, you know, they're not even a performer, never mind a singer, just somebody in sports or politics. And they turn out to be the best host because the expectations of you, the audience, and everybody is so low. There's no pressure. And then it's a great show.
I saw Brian Williams on there a few years ago, and he was, like, genuinely funny.
Right. Yeah. Everyone says he's funny.
Yeah.
But now he's not even the big star in his family. Allison is.
Oh, that's right. And she's on Girls. And did you go to the premiere last night?
I was at the premiere last night, yeah.
And how did that go?
Oh, my God. It was really, I mean, they showed 3 episodes.
Uh-huh.
You know, that Lena Dunham, I mean, she's just got some, you know what I mean? She's just, talk about a unique kind of, you know what I mean?
She's fearless.
Yes. And she's just, you know, she's just got her tone. She's not trying to be the hip voice of a generation. You know, she's just doing her thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Is she, I mean, she's young, right? She's like 26, 27?
Yeah, 27 or something like that.
I think the amazing thing about her is that there's been great praise for the show. There's been great criticism of the show. And it seems like she has maintained her course, not paying too much attention to either side.
Right, right. She does seem like a very, she seems like a very even-keeled type individual. But even before she did that show, she did that movie, Tiny Furniture, when she was like 23. That movie was amazing.
So how much does your show change from city to city, from night to night, depending on what's going on in the world?
It changes from night to night because of the news, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like anything in the news affects the show. But at the same time, I've never done, I guess I'm going to New Orleans, then Dallas. And I guess those are the first states that were not part of the original 13. All the other states, I've mentioned something about them being part of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time I'm going to be with states that were not the original 13. So I'll probably have a few things to say about it. I know I have a few things about Texas that are interesting as far as their whole relationship to the United States when they came in. You know what I mean? So that kind of stuff affects the show.
Now, I think people here will eat that up.
Yeah, sure.
So do you have, like, pre-show rituals? What is the last, 10 minutes before you go on stage feel like for you? Or what does it look like?
The last 10 minutes, I usually, like, listen to some of the parts of the show. Like, I'm just kind of writing little notes to myself and listening to the last few minutes of the show for the last hour. Just so I don't miss any. The thing I hate the worst is when I miss something I wanted to say that was funny or I made a point or something. I hate when that happens, but it happens.
It would seem hard because if you're doing it so many times in a row, you might think, oh, I already did that. But in fact, that was 3 days ago in, Toledo.
That doesn't happen at the same night. But if you do two shows a night or three shows a night, that could happen. Yeah.
Have you ever just completely lost it for a while and had to work your way through to find the next chunk of material?
No. In stand-up, that happened to me a couple of times, though. When I first started out, when I didn't have that much material. Now I have so much, I'm such a big mouth over the years, I have something to say about everything. I don't even know when I'm talking on stage or off stage sometimes. But when I first started, I didn't have that much material. Sometimes I'd be up there like with nothing to say and just you repeating something and trying to figure out what am I going to talk about, you know?
I guess once you realize you can survive that, you can survive anything.
Yeah, it's definitely, although sometimes you don't survive that, which is happens to a lot of people.
Well, Colin Quinn, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. The live show is Friday, January 10th at the Wiley Theater in Dallas. I'm sure a lot of people are looking forward to it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Colin Quinn joined us today from Argo Studios in New York City. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. If you want to contact me on Twitter, I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can get to the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.